Our speaker is Peter Bussey, and his topic is natural law, God's law in our hearts. So welcome, Peter, and look forward to your talk.
Thank you. Natural law is the basic sense of right and wrong, which we, nearly all of us, have in everyday life. And the argument is that this is authentic and should be taken notice of. Now, the best definition that I have found is that given by a pre-Christian speaker, orator, Marcus Tullius Cicero, well known, and he said, "There is a true law, a right reason, conformable to nature, whose commands urge us to duty, and whose prohibitions restrain us from evil. Not one thing in Rome, another in Athens, but in all times and nations must forever reign. God himself is its author. He who obeys it not flies from himself and does violence to the very nature of man." And that is an excellent description of what we're going to be talking about. But of course, you do have to ask, is he right? Is there such a thing? Now, C.S. Lewis produced some evidence. He said, well, if you look around the world and look over history and over various cultures, you find a lot of very similar moral principles. And he gave a list of these. Respect parents, do not murder. So this is, as it were, the Ten Commandments. And you can see a whole lot of these from Babylon, from India, Egypt, various others. I won't go through them all, but you can get the gist that different cultures certainly had a lot of different, a lot of very similar ideas and taken them very seriously. And says C.S. Lewis, this is real. Well, in European history, the person who sort of founded a philosophical discussion of this was mainly Thomas Aquinas, who was in the 13th century. And he said there are, in fact, three areas of natural law, and they have been implanted on nature by God, and they are universal. Well, physical law, we know about laws of nature, but he was more concerned with laws that just affect how animals behave, and on top of that, laws that apply to human beings. And we as human animals share in animal nature. And he pointed out that we rationally discern objective good and evil. He emphasized that this is objective, it's not subjective. We know that we ought to do good and avoid evil. We have consciences which tell us about this. It is both individual and societal, because societies can also be collectively wrong. And what immediately gives rise to problems is what he called disordered appetites. And we also need scripture to guide us, because sometimes our consciences and judgments don't work particularly well. So this is what we're talking about, is rather like a moral compass, and it points to what is good, but there are several questions that need to be asked, especially in a scientific age. First is there indeed such a thing as absolute objective moral law? Christians would certainly say yes, but there are skeptics who would say, no, there's no such thing. Now, Aquinas imagined God creating humans perfect some thousands of years ago, but now we have a different story. We have a story of human evolution, and from the animal world, as the illustration at the bottom points out, we have human beings coming about. Big questions here, but at some point, morality became relevant. And also, we should at least ask, is there really such a thing as human nature? Because human nature is what we're supposed to be obedient to as God has given it to us. Well, here are three basic positions. As I've just said, at the top left you have Nietzsche, the nihilistic philosopher who thought that morality is for the suckers, as it were. What was wanted was willpower and strength. Or maybe it's just social conventions. This is a very common point of view. So everybody chooses to walk in step in a given society, and the society functions well, and that's okay. But of course, there's no way that you can argue about absolute morality now. It's just what people think is best. Or is it indeed God's wishes for us? And here you have a familiar picture of the Ten Commandments. Now, to justify the statement that for real morality you need God, I'll quote an unusual source, Richard Dawkins, who wrote, "It is pretty hard to defend absolutist morals on grounds other than religious ones." And this is, of course, the position that I'm taking. So, to take stock, we are spiritualized physical beings with a moral sense. The claim is that God has sent this in us and is in principle universal and reliable. We may indeed have personal and social drives and pressures, that they do exist, but objective moral value is a further quality. And without God's authority, moral inclinations are best of social or biological origin. There is no absolute ought. It doesn't provide the vocabulary. And I now point out that even unbelievers can possess this if God has really put it in us. So we can discuss morality and things with humanists, only while they take it very seriously, they don't have any real warrant for believing in what they're discussing. But it can be within them nevertheless, because God has hopefully put it there. And just a word about who we are. Aquinas pointed out a concept of well-functioning human nature. He may have not have used precisely those words, but that's what it boils down to. God has, in principle, made us so that we can function well, both individually and in society. And both C.S. Lewis and John Paul II argued against a mind-body dualism in which mind and body are separate. C.S. Lewis pointed out that if that's what you have, then you just have people with minds and people with appetites. He called them men without chests. We might add it, no heart. Well, one can point out various stereotypes here. Let's say an academic person in a university who is at the same time very lecherous, that would be someone with a mind and appetites, and so on and so on. You can think of people like that. John Paul emphasized that we are personal beings, and the entire body is important, not just the slave of the mind. We are united, integrated. He talked of us as spiritualized matter. So, from the scientific and evolutionary point of view, the question is, as animals become humans, how did we become beings with moral values and obligations? Well, here are some chimps. Chimpanzees can behave very badly to each other. They have behavior patterns, but we wouldn't normally say that they have morality. There are a few philosophers who think otherwise, but most people would say that a chimp is just a chimp and don't like that behavior, but there we are. And on the right, someone who was certainly aware of the need for moral awareness, compassion, and all the qualities that we would associate with that, there is Teresa, Sister Teresa of Calcutta. And we can refer to Darwin himself. He was a very honest man, and he said he fully subscribed to the judgment that of all the differences between man and the lower animals, the moral sense or conscience is the most important. This is very much a question that needs addressing. Now, to say a little bit more about evolution and behavior, Dennis Alexander said a lot about this yesterday, but just to summarize a few things. Well, behavior can be genetically determined or all the other factors as well, or it can be culturally and group determined. So you have a picture of a peacock doing the things that peacocks do. And on the right, you have a group of animals who learn how to behave by following their elders and fellow group members. And both of these elements can influence each other. I mean, if you've got a certain behavior that is helpful, then you might well imagine that genetic mutations that assist this could get built into the system. But I don't really want to talk about this, except to say that advanced species are neither genetically determined nor a blank slate, as many argue, and the two elements are interconnected. So, here's now something about humans. Well, we know about Australopithecus, an ape-like ancestor who lived 2 to 4 million years ago and looked more like an ape than like a human. But the development occurred. Homo erectus was sort of 2 million years ago and so on. And this creature was quite large, 1.8 meters high, same height as us, and had tools and fire, rather human. Now, Neanderthals also appeared. At the top right, you can see a model of a supposed Neanderthal in an office dress. Now, you might be rather surprised if your bank manager looked like that, but it's not entirely impossible. They were really quite close to us. Down at the bottom, you'll see some modern people who are believed to be very close to the original Homo sapiens. These are sand people of, I believe it's Botswana. So they are very nice looking people, and they look just like us, really. So somehow, you've got to decide about morality and moral values. We wouldn't necessarily be sure that Australopithecus had them. Another factor is that our ancestors, we believe, emerged out of Africa. Now, I have to say that this picture is a few years old, and knowledge is always being developed. So the latest scholarship may say something slightly different, but the point is basically the same, that there have been migrations. There was believed to be a first wave, the old Stone Age, and then there was a second wave of some 60,000 years ago. Both dates have uncertainties, and the Middle Paleolithic people used lots of stone axe heads of a rather common pattern, but by the time you get to the Upper Paleolithic, which means more recent, there are marked advances in art techniques and body ornaments, and so on. And this is very interesting. At what point do we try to affirm that moral qualities were present too? Well, what do modern anthropologists do? They often go around isolated communities in different parts of the world to try and find out what their social practices are and their values. So here we've got some examples. There's some Inuit from northern Canada, there's some Amazon people, some African pygmies, and some folk from Papua New Guinea, all of whom are human beings, just like us, and they've got rather different cultures, you might think, but anthropologists try to find things that most of the peoples around the earth have in common. So this is a search for human universals, human nature, we'll go on to say. And what do they find? Well, it's rather difficult to get too much from paleontological studies because they don't say much about the culture, but it is believed to be hard to avoid the conclusion that social norms have always existed. But that's not a very strong statement, but it's all we can say. Modern anthropology can go into much more detail. And we want to find features that may indicate a common human nature. And we're talking about something which is common to all these people who have spread around the world. And here are two names of distinguished anthropologists, Donald Blaum and Dr. Ivel Iversfelt. And they say that you can identify hundreds of social and behavioral features that may be broadly called human universals. And some of these we may regard as morally relevant. And we can talk about a cultural and a biological inheritance. Not all groups are the same, but they do have a lot of things in common. There's a list. Well, at bottom left and right, you've got a musician from India and a group of musicians, I believe, from somewhere in Eastern Europe. And that's just one example, music. So kin groups, music, poetry, rights, obligations, and many others. I'll just leave you to read the rest of the list. So one can certainly talk about human nature in isolated groups now and presumably in the past as well. So now we get back to the morality question. Now, anthropologists and paleontologists don't have any problem in discussing social norms. They're just what people do. And it's reasonable, one could say, to see human nature in these observed human universals. But while many of them do align with Christian moral perceptions, being nice to your neighbor and so on, others don't seem to do that. You can observe xenophobia, revenge, honor killings, and abducting women. That's done here and there. So what does this say about well-functioning human nature? Is it then just an ideal? Has it ever been a reality? Now, I've argued that a moral disposition is real and that it's more than just social norms. Something qualitatively new and different. Darwin tried to give an explanation, perhaps not very successfully. How do we come to have this factor? So now I have to speak as a Christian believer. I have to say that authentic moral reality is God-based, and at some point in our history, God uplifted the newly evolved humans to a new level of spiritual awareness and partnership. In other words, creation was finished. And this resulted in truly human beings who were well-functioning and gave moral values to us, which are objective. So this is the Adam and Eve story, but I'm not saying that it was necessarily just two people. Maybe it's easier to suppose that God uplifted spiritually the whole of the human race at that time. Not clear when it's happened. But after that, there was an incursion of evil, and we can discuss spiritually what may have happened there. So at the bottom right, you can see just a picture of Adam and Eve as originally created in the story, but I'm not saying it was just two people. And when did this happen? Very hard to tell. If you want to ask this question in depth, there's a book by Lauren Haasmer, When Did Sin Begin? And that contains a lot of thinking about all the possibilities. He doesn't give any real answers, but it's well worth looking at and reading. So this then is the story that I'm suggesting. I'm not suggesting that morality gradually evolved, and we gradually behave more and more morally. I don't think that's entirely true. I'm saying that the Genesis story does at least tell us that God created us and finished the job. And it then says that some evil came about in the world, not, of course, necessarily because of us a talking serpent, but through other means. So that then is for original sin. We are fallen from our intended human condition. We still retain many traces of it. Our conscience does exist. We do have a certain awareness of right and wrong. I do not believe that we are all of us totally depraved in this in this way. No, we are sort of fallen, but we still have enough of the image of God in us to be recognizable. And the issue is then that we are very much controlled, unfortunately, by the flesh, which I interpret to represent our evolved animal earthly condition. In other words, what came out of evolution is the flesh, but God did give to the human race spiritual qualities which need to be restored. And here are some relevant biblical verses. Genesis chapter 5, people usually stop at chapter 4, but this is important. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He made them male and female and blessed them. Then it says, Adam had a son in his own likeness, his own image, and he named him Seth. So a divine quality is passed on. Then Paul's famous statement, when Gentiles who do not have the Mosaic law do by nature things that are required, they show that the requirements of the law are written in their hearts. So the Ten Commandments, people will normally acknowledge as being good principles. However, turn to Colossians chapter 3, we need to be restored. This is what the Christian gospel is about. And he says to the new Christians, you've taken off the old self. I would think it would be better to say that is being supplemented and overcome by the new self, which is the restored image of its creator. Christ is all and in all. So the image of God is in us is degraded and needs to be renewed. Well, a few implications. No time to discuss details. We have God-given inclinations towards well-functioning human nature. Both are imperfectly present in us now. Natural law simply states that we ought to obey these inclinations. We should recognize them as good. They are in conflict with those of the flesh. We need scriptural guidance. And one can identify three areas of ethics. Social, which without getting particularly political, means honesty, fair laws, unbiased courts, and so on. Personal character, there are seven deadly sins. We need to think about all that. And there needs to be a respect for our physical nature, good sexual conduct, and so on. And so this is a basic summary of what I've been saying. I won't go through all this. But I'll just leave it up there. There is this compass within us which we should follow. We do need guidance from scriptures. And please, if you are interested, consult the longer article which I published on this in Science and Christian Beliefs, and it's now open access, and you ought to be able to read it. So thank you very much.
A very stimulating talk.
Have you read William Lane Craig's book on this
topic? I'm
going
to have to come closer.
William Lane Craig wrote a book on this. He's a Christian apologetist,
yes.
And we discussed it in Diving Deeper.
Yeah. I'm aware of William Lane Craig. I greatly admire him. He is seeking some point where the original Adam and Eve materialized. He has his theories. I haven't actually read his book. I'm sure it makes some sense, but these things are always progressing in scholarship, and you know, one should read it and decide what you think.
Thank you for your thoughtful treatment. I really appreciate the talk and look forward to reading your article. I'm curious if resistance to your arguments has changed over time. I'm not sure how long you've been doing this, but the Nietzsche seems to not be... I work with young people, and they're all for absolutes. They may not be the Christian absolutes, but they have their own. And I'm wondering if you've noticed resistance to absolute morality lessening over time.
Well, I don't think that there's anything here apart perhaps from the hypothesizing about
our human ancestors, which is from the ethical point of view, very, very new. I haven't, to answer your question, no, I haven't had people say, no, I don't believe in any of this. But you can certainly see people around who don't seem to have any real values. And from time to time, people will come up with this. But I think it's not very strong because it just leads you nowhere.
Thank you for this. Quick question when it comes to natural law theory is quite often natural law theorists will disagree when it comes to when you have two different appetites that are competitive. So for instance, like I might really, really want food, but I also, you know, am fasting for, say, a spiritual purpose, right? And I'm just curious how you, you know, I know how Thomas Aquinas might do it, but I'm curious how you personally, how do you weigh out whenever we have natural appetites, both arising from a nature, maybe one from a spiritual appetite, maybe one from a...
I'm not quite sure how I've understood your question. Can you repeat?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Let me just simplify it real quick. How would you, as a natural law theorist, how do you deal with debates about how do we deal with competing appetites? So for instance, like I want to fast because of a spiritual purpose, but I also like have a, I'm hungry, and that's a different appetite and a different nature. So how would it, how would you, I know how Aquinas does, but I'm curious if you particularly have a way that you are able to deal with this.
Okay, now one should say that nature doesn't always work as it should. We may have disordered appetites, which are quite seriously problematic. There's no sin in being tempted. Sin is when we give way to temptations. So if you have engaged in a commitment to fast, but you would rather not fast, that temptation is not sinful in itself. But you should pray for spiritual strength to resist the temptation. Does that answer your question?
Let's give our thanks to Peter. Thank you.